Ladies and gentlemen, the story you are about to hear is true.
Dateline, Tucson, Arizona. At 11:15 p.m. on October 12th, two men were leaning on their cars at their apartment at 3055 North Tyndall Avenue when two masked men approached them and demanded money at gunpoint. Both victims were armed, drew their guns, and effectively engaged their attackers with defensive gunfire. Both dialed 911, put their guns down, and waited for police. Arriving officers found both perpetrators, 26 and 41, with multiple gunshot wounds and declared them both DRT, or dead, right there. Both victims gave statements to the police and were released. No charges are pending, and detectives are investigating, according to KVOA television. This has been the DGU Files.
The story you have just heard was true.
America Armed and Free is a paid program on KVOI, wholly owned by Charles Heller, produced, engineered, paid for, and hosted by him. Any opinions are his, not necessarily the station's.
I, Harry S. Truman, President of the United States, dedicate this day of Sunday to America Armed and Free.
The Constitution does not say that government shall decree the right to keep and bear arms. The Constitution says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
I am a minute man. I am the guardian of America, armed and free. For we knew it will always be the citizen who is the guardian of America, armed and free.
Welcome to America Armed and Free, a program dedicated to preserving your God-granted, constitutionally guaranteed individual right to keep and bear arms in defense of self or state, understanding that the citizens are the militia. This program is produced by Charles Heller and is not endorsed by anyone who isn't pro-choice on freedom.
We are the guardians of America, armed and free.
And welcome. Indeed, we are the guardians of America Armed and Free, both in uniform, as my guest very much was for over 30 years, and myself, who was not. And it's Colonel William Dunn, and it's a joy and a pleasure and an honor to bring you to the microphones and telephones on this anniversary of the Marine Corps today, November 10th, on America Armed and Free. Welcome.
Well, thank you, sir. Thanks for having me. And it is our 249th birthday. Hoorah!
Yeah, it is indeed. And you have a wonderful book, 354 pages, about your growing up, sort of a combination of an autobiography and a history of your service. I got to about the first 110 pages of it. Sorry, I wanted to read the whole thing, and I flat ran out of time at about 2:30 this morning trying to get much further. So, man, what a career you had, though, you know, growing up and losing your dad to cancer at age 11 and having the house burned down and stuff like that, and then ending up in joining the Marine Corps, sort of your lifelong dream, joining the Marine Corps at 17. How, if you had it to do over again, would you?
Oh, absolutely. 100%. I loved it. I still love the Marine Corps. I still work with the Marine Corps on a daily basis as a retired guy with running my own company. And I absolutely love it. You know, not everything is great in every service. Sometimes we have some challenges and a few individuals here and there. But as an institution, the Marine Corps is just, in my mind, the greatest service we got there in the world.
You know, there is this family of Marines. You mentioned it when you had a disciplinary issue that could have cost you your career, and other guys knew that you were a good guy and they made sure that you learned a lesson from it, but that you weren't drummed out of the Corps. Talk about that ethos, if you would.
Well, you know, you don't want to go to war with choir boys, right? And that's a fact. You know, we train Marines, the government trains Marines, and the Marine Corps trains Marines to be killers. And so it takes a very special kind of person, very special mentality to give up everything you've learned as a young child and then decide one day that your job and your vocation is going to be to kill people and to be able to fight and defend our nation. So that also requires a certain type of person. You know, we don't always follow all the rules. And so when I was a very young Marine, I found myself, you know, what I say skirting the rules quite a bit. And I got caught, got in trouble. And my senior Marines could have absolutely smoke checked me. And instead I always call it paying the piper, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you got kind of get an option. Do you want to get what's called non-judicial punishment, or do you want to pay the piper? And usually, at least when I was in command, I always made the piper option worse, right? But then there was no paperwork trail, nothing.
Right.
So you get in trouble, you pay the piper, and then you move on, and then there's no paperwork, and so it never happened, and that's how we take care of our own in the Marine Corps. And I would tell you this, there's leaders in the Marine Corps every day, 24/7, that are taking care of their men and women by doing that, because they know if you kick everybody out for making a mistake, there'll be no one in the Marine Corps. We'll be empty.
Right. Or it would be choir boys.
Or we would be choir boys, and then we'd lose.
Yeah. Why do some people in politics not understand the necessity of doing things the way you guys do?
Well, many of them have never served.
Yeah.
And I speak to a lot of people, both military, both retired military, former military, and, you know, Marines. You know, there's no former Marines, but they, mm-hmm. you know, if you're in the Army, they'll say, I was a former Army guy. but it is a dilemma. When you think about what we train men and women to do, to go fight and to go deploy and then to leave their families behind, if you don't experience that and don't understand that, then it's very easy, in my mind, for you to send Marines into combat, mm-hmm. or to send soldiers into combat, or to send our special ops people into combat. If you don't understand what it's like to come under fire mm-hmm. and to have your friends killed, then it's easy to do. And I am very grateful that our soon-to-be vice president has spent some time in the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that he will at least bring to this administration a great understanding of what it's like to put Marines in harm's way, because he's been in harm's way.
Yeah, he has. He knows the definition of incoming.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. You headed at one point the 22nd Marine Expeditionary Unit, which was your lifetime goal. When you assumed command there, I mean, this isn't a program that deals very much with feelings, but how did it feel?
Well, it was probably, I was very blessed. As a Marine, I commanded a gun squadron in combat, the gunfighters, hence the title of the book, Gunfighters Rule.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to school, what's called top-level school. And then I get called up by one of my generals, and he says, "Hey, I'm going to put you in command of MAG 40." Mm-hmm. And normally a Marine colonel gets one command.
Mm-hmm.
So I get command of MAG 40. I deploy, and then there's a whole bunch of drama with then state, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in Bahrain. So the deployment gets turned off.
Mm-hmm.
So I get put back in the zone for command. I put in, I want to be a MEU commander. I had done 3 MEUs as a young lieutenant, a captain, and as a major, and my goal in life in the Marine Corps was to be a MEU commander. So I put in for it. I get selected for MEU command the same week they turn on my deployment.
Hmm.
And so now I deploy as a MAG commander for 2 years. I come back, and then I deploy as a MEU commander for 2 years. So I spent my whole colonelcy pretty much in command. And that was a great honor. I had, unbelievable men and women on both deployments. So it was great. But it's funny, the day I took command of the MEU, I had this overwhelming sense of sadness. because I knew I was the new commands are 2 years long. I knew I was giving up command in 2 years, and I made a solemn promise to myself that I was going to enjoy every day, because that clock, when you walk into a command, that clock starts ticking, and it goes fast.
It's like being at the end of a career of the service life of a naval vessel if you're the last skipper.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Be the decommissioning. I knew a guy that was on the decommissioning crew of the Nautilus, and
oh wow, yeah,
and it was kind of bittersweet. You know, it's wonderful to serve on a historic boat, and it's also sad to know that it's going to be it's now going to be a museum. I guess at least it's better than being razor blades.
Well, it is, and it is interesting because I've served with tons and tons of sailors, and the sailors are just as motivated about their ships as we are motivated about our Marine Corps.
Yeah.
And they take it personal.
Oh, did they ever?
Oh, yeah. And it's great, right? Because, we give each other a lot of kidding, a lot of ribbing between the Navy and the Marine Corps, but they are the most professional Navy in the world. And they will, they'll get us where we're going, and they will also protect us all the way through.
Yep. My friend Duke says that Marine stands for My Ass Rides in Navy Equipment.
Well, the other thing that we always say, right, because the Navy is right, they always say, Marine Corps, you are a department of the Navy.
Right.
And we always respond, we are. We are the men's department.
You can't completely say that since actually the late 40s, right?
Well, in our lady Marines, they understand, and they're always part of us. And our lady Marines are just as tough as our men Marines. And I've been in combat with ladies, and they take it to the enemy just as well as we do, and they do it with a sense of flair that is pretty motivating.
Are there very many female Cobra attack pilots?
There's not many. There's a handful. I don't know the total number, but I've served with several of them. And, it's funny. I talk about one of the female Cobra pilots I knew in the book.
Uh-huh. I missed that part. Sorry.
Well, hopefully you'll get to it. So she has a baby, right? So she has a baby, and she's breastfeeding, and the Marine Corps ball's coming up.
Yeah.
So she comes up to me and she says, "Hey, sir, I'm not going to go to the ball this year because I'm having a hard time breastfeeding."
Yeah.
And I said, "Oh, well, okay, whatever." Well, a few days later, one of my squadron that I was not in command of it, the gunfighter was already deployed. I was going to take command of it in a few months, and two of our fine Marines were killed. They were shot down and killed, and they had to be replaced. The next day she walks in my office and she says, "Hey, sir, I volunteer to go to Iraq." And I say to her, I said, hey, devil dog, last night you couldn't go to the ball because you're breastfeeding. Today you want to go to Iraq? She goes, "I can't kill people at the ball." And I was like, yeah, I love it. Now, she didn't end up going, but she and that's how dedicated. And, this is a call out to all my sisters in the Marine Corps. They're just as tough, and they deploy, they get shot at, and they will kill just as the men do. And, shout out to them. Happy birthday to them as well. But we're one team, one fight. And I tell you what, we are a force to be reckoned with.
I love it. All right. Well, stand by. We're up on our first break, and we'll be back after this whole hour with Colonel William Dunn and his wonderful book, Gunfighter's Rule. I plan on finishing it this weekend while I'm doing some laundry. So stand by. Stand by.
Swap shop trains coming, rolling down that free market track. Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the swap shop. Let's listen.
Don Wells, is there anything you missed on the island?
Oh, well, actually, what I really missed, there we were with nothing to do. What I missed most was the swap shop. I mean, what fun we'd have had. I don't know how we'd have gotten a hold of you, but we'd have tried.
Swap shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
I'm Oliver North, and like you, I'm listening on America Armed and Free with Charles Heller. Civilian disarmament is an essential precedent for every dictator who engages in mass murder.
Hi, Mark Levin here. America Armed and Free. Sounds like a good title for a book. Congratulations on 20 years on KVOI, Charles.
Nothing can stop these lonely tears from falling. Tell me, baby, where did I go wrong? I can put my arms around every boy I see.
And welcome back to America Armed and Free. Now, we haven't suddenly gone soft while talking to a Marine. This is Colonel William Dunn. And if I remember right, that Sinead O'Connor song had a meaning for you and your wife.
It did. It did. It's funny, when I heard it, it just made me think about it. You know, when I was a young lieutenant in flight school, that's when that song came out.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just reminds me. It always takes me back to the T-34 Turbo Mentor.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first plane I learned how to fly in, you know, back in naval flight school at NAS Pensacola.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I pay attention when people talk about music in a book. It means that it had meaning to them, or they wouldn't have wrote about it. And so
That's
kind of how I try to acknowledge people for what they did. How much work did you put into writing the book?
You know, it's interesting. I probably wrote the book in 3 weeks, start to finish. It took me several years after that to get it published because it's a very personal, very stressful, very stressful book. And a lot of, you know, as a fighter in combat, you know, a lot of memories of those that came up in my mind, you know, they're very painful. And then many of my peers have read the book. And it brings them straight back to some of their, you know, I don't want to call them demons, but some of their memories that that bring you back right into fighting.
Yeah, it brings you back to your experience.
It does, and even today, you know, just an interesting piece. The book just came out as an ebook, and you know, I'm working through Gatekeeper Press, and they sent me a version of it, so I had to reread it again. And even to this day, when I read my own book, you know, obviously that I lived and wrote. It stresses me out greatly.
Huh, that's interesting.
My heart's pounding. I go back to some of the memories of combat in Iraq and, you know, some of the very, very close calls that not only me, but, you know, all my Marines had.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes very stressful. That said, you know, that's part of the reason why I wrote it. And it's
catharsis.
It's a great release for that. Yeah, a little catharsis there. And it's a good thing. And my daughter read it. And I just happened to be home while
your
she
daughter,
was reading it.
Your daughter Bug?
The Bug.
Yeah, right.
And
okay.
The Bug is reading the book, and as she's reading it, I look at her, and she's bawling.
Yeah.
And then 10 minutes later, she's laughing.
Yeah.
And then 10 minutes later, she's appalled. And, you know, that cycle goes through about three or four times throughout the book. So.
Well, it opens with describing killing somebody. And so, you know, that's kind of stark.
Yeah, it was a tough day.
Yeah.
And I, in my memory of the white shirt man, I can never do his suffering justice.
Right.
And that, you know, that was a hard thing for me because he was dying and I was the one that caused that. And then he wouldn't die.
Yeah.
And so I see this individual who I could just tell he's suffering. I just could not, in essence, finish him off. Yeah, even though I tried, and eventually some indirect fire, I think, took them out. But, you know, and that is one thing I want the listeners, at least in my opinion, you know, even though they're enemy and I have no remorse for killing them, I do not take the taking of a human life lightly. And I would hope that all my brothers and sisters in the military would feel that way because, you know, if we weren't fighting our enemies, in many instances, we would be hanging out with them drinking beer. Just like, you know, we've done with, in the past, we've shared, you know, I haven't personally done it, but, you know, our services have shared beer, whiskey, and everything with Russian forces, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now we're, in essence, enemies. So there's not that fine of a line between the people that are serving their country is that they're just people like us.
Yeah.
They just have different ideology.
If you want a good example of that, submariners of opposing forces, when they meet in, you know, in non-military venues, are great friends. And the guy, the used to be governor of Arizona, Evan Meekum, was a P-38 pilot, one of the few to survive getting shot down by a Messerschmitt 262. And some 20 years later, he was at a reunion of fighter pilots in Germany, and he happened to overhear a Messerschmitt talk about shooting down a P-38 that exploded, and it matched the description of his shootdown. He says, that guy didn't make it. And Meekum said, I think he did. And when they compared notes, they found out that he was the one that was shot down. And they remain friends for the rest of their lives. And that's a bond that very few people share.
Yeah, that just sent the, you know, that just sent the EBGBs through me a little bit. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, they would have killed each other just as soon as look at each other, and now they're friends. And so that's a testament to, you know, we military people fight for their governments and for each other. But, you know, we have civilian control of the military, and they give you a direct order and you go execute. And it, you may not agree with it, but would you sign up and take an oath? That's what you do.
Right. One of the things I want to get to is families. But before we do that, I want to talk a little bit. And I also want to get back to the combat aspect of it. But I don't want to be ghoulish and only talk about that. I'm trying to want to be a little bit more holistic about talking about your book, give people a sort of the meets and the bounds of it. But let's talk a little bit today. Tomorrow's going to be Veterans Day. Today is the anniversary of the Marine Corps. Talk about authentic veteran appreciation. Why do some traditional thank you gestures miss the mark? And what does really make a difference for people?
Well, you know, that's a great question. Whenever somebody walks up to me and says, thank you for your service, I appreciate that. Many of my peers don't, right? Many of my peers are like, yeah, you know, whatever. And they don't mean that in a negative way, but they will take it in an assumption that the person that's saying that is just placating them. And, you know, the other thing that we hear a lot, and I just heard this the other day, is a lot of people say, hey, thanks for your service. Well, I was going to join the Marine Corps, but, you know, I had a twisted ankle. Or I was going to join the Marine Corps, but I didn't because of this. And they'll give you some sort of excuse, right? And that may or may not be true. But in many veterans believe, and, you know, I'm not speaking for them. I'm just talking about my peers that have discussed this with me. They believe that some people, some civilians, are just placating them just because.
Maybe they're placating themselves.
Maybe they're placating themselves. Now, me, I never take it that way. If you come up and thank me, what I always say was my pleasure, it was my honor, and, you know, I loved it. I will literally say that. I'll say, yeah, I appreciate that. I love the Marine Corps. And, there, you know, that, a lot of times that takes them back. But I don't think if a civilian or anybody is earnest in wanting to thank a veteran, I think they should. And, you know, the veteran should be humble enough to accept that without thinking that it's, you know, a bad thing. And I believe most of the time it's not.
Why?
I just do. I believe somebody walked. I just think people appreciate it.
Huh.
You know, I think America really does appreciate their service members, of course, until they don't. I was alive during the Vietnam War. I was a young lad, and my dad served in Vietnam. And I remember clearly how civilians were treating.
Oh, that was despicable.
Our people. It's despicable.
It was despicable. You don't do that. And
you don't do that.
It was when we lost a part of our soul as Americans. No matter what you thought of the war, you don't disrespect the people who are serving their country. It just makes no sense. We got a caller, Rick, that wants to ask you something. Rick, go ahead.
I don't like to say, because it kind of sounds trite and it sounds canned, the thank you for your service, even though it may be deserved and it may be sincere. And so if I have time, so if I meet somebody and they've served, if I have time, I'll try and ask them a question. So I had a buddy, close buddy, that was in Vietnam, and I've studied a lot about Vietnam. So I see a Vietnam vet, and I might ask him, where were you at? What branch were you in? you know, try and get some background and show some interest, because I am interested in the same thing. I spent some time about every part of Afghanistan as a advisor and with the DOD contracted advisor. And so I also spent some time in Iraq. And so if I talk to somebody, I'll just ask them, well, where were you at? And, you know, we might have been in the same area in Afghanistan, at least. And I think it's a better way. It's at least for me personally. And it just, you know, just saying the kind of that canned mechanical thank you for your service. I think that's better than not thanking them for their service. But me personally, I like to add a personal touch to it. And I met a guy that was in Vietnam, and I ended up talking to him for probably 45 minutes. Now, I've got time during the day to do this, so not everybody's got places to go, but that's how I like to do it. I can't speak for other people, and I don't want to say that somebody else, I don't want to diminish someone's appreciation, but that's how I like to do it.
No, and I think that's great, and people will know, and this is what I'm saying, most of the people that have ever come up to me, I believe they were sincere, and I have no issue with it. I think that's great. One thing I always find out, especially if I'm talking to another veteran, we find out very quickly that we chewed up some of the same dirt together. You know, I was in Iraq on this date, or I was in Iraq on this date, or I was at Paris Island on this date, and it happens all the time. And, you know, I see lots of Vietnam veterans, and I'll walk up to them, and I'll say, hey, thank you for your service, sir, and I'll say, hey, thanks for paving the way for us. And I hope they like it. But, you know, I think as a human being, people see through you if you're being fake or insincere. And if you're not, there's no reason not to. And well, I would be upset if a Marine said, well, I can't believe they thanked me for my service. I'd be like, hey, devil dog, you should be glad they thank you. You know, that's my thought.
I always thank the submariners for their service, Bubblehead. And they get it.
Yeah. That's right.
All right, Rick, appreciate it. We're at the bottom of the hour. We've got to take that break. I've got so many things. I want to talk about combat. I want to talk about families. I want to talk about the transition from military to civilian service. There's a bunch of other things I want to catch before we become victims of the clock. So we'll be back on the other side of the break with Colonel William Dunn of the book Gunfighter's Rule. It's very good. I'm into it, the first 105 pages, and it's wonderful. Go get the book Gunfighter's Rule.
Welcome to Monoral Radio, where we sing in black and white.
And welcome back. We're talking to a real warrior. Colonel William Dunn is a veteran of the Marine Corps, and he ended his career as a colonel in charge of a Marine Expeditionary Unit. And talk a little bit about the times that are most memorable for you in combat, if you would, Colonel Dunn.
Okay, thanks. You know, there's a lot of them. I was in combat as a forward air controller during OAF-1. Then I went back as part of the squadron that I was getting ready to take command of. It was about five or six months before I took command. And so I did some combat there, and then I took command of the gunfighters. We did our 11-month workup and went back into combat for 7 months straight, and that was basically combat every single day. All of those were combat every day. And then when I finished up as a MU commander, you know, one of the things that we did is we went back into Iraq. I had to put my Marines and sailors back in harm's way. So, the things that really, really jump out at me, you know, one is as a service as a whole. Nobody I have ever been around shied away from gunfire. Not one person. Not one pilot. Not one private, not one Lance Corporal, not one Colonel, not one. And, you know, one of my great memories, and I think I actually didn't, I wasn't very specific about this in the book, but we were you know, a Marine got shot, and I was escorting, me and another Cobra were escorting a 46 in to pick him up. And we're flying in, the Cobras go in, we don't see anybody shooting, because normally the Iraqis did not shoot at us. And then the frog starts his approach, and we're talking to the ground guys, and the ground guy starts screaming at the frog to wave off. He said, they're shooting at you with a machine gun. So me and the other Cobra dived down in front of the, we're looking for the machine gun to take it out. We dive down in front of the frog, but we can't see the machine gun. And the guys get out of here, get out of here, they're going to kill you. And the frog pilot, CH-46 pilot, Marine, goes, I have to come in and get him. He's bleeding. And he landed, his whole crew, of course, his whole crew was on board. So they land, and then they get this young man out of there, and they, you know, hopefully save his life. You know, one of my personal, you know, most intense days was, it's part of the book. It's a chapter in the book called Gunfighter Village.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long day. We start out, we are going to do a very benign day, and within minutes we're in combat. And we were in combat. Our squadron was in combat all day long, trying to save some soldiers. A couple of them had been blown to bits. And then we find an entire unit that's been separated, a small unit, a squad that's been separated from the unit, and they're in bad guy territory. And then one of my pilots, Hawk, you know, you have to read the book to get the whole deal, but this is, you know, 120 degrees. These men have been out there for days. They're all, you know, under, almost dying of heat stroke. And we get a call on this radio from a Marine that's with this Army unit, and he says, basically, if you don't get my guys out of here, we're all going to die. So one of my Hueys goes in, picks up a whole bunch of soldiers, and then, you know, he shouldn't have done that. And then we come back, and then this Marine gets on the radio with me, and he says, I'm being overrun. Well, they're in the forest, you know, they're little palm groves. I can't see anybody. So what I do is I just basically have them pop a smoke grenade, mm-hmm. and then I take my 20 millimeter and I circle them. And so I'm just shooting around this guy and shooting. And I'm, you know, well, everybody's on the radio. It's intense. And I'm like, you guys got to fight, because they were dying. They were literally physically dying because they hadn't, you know, they were out of water. So we do this for a while. We finally get in a 46. They get shot at. Insurgents all over the place shooting at us. Two guys run into a building. They open up on the 46 with machine guns, and I put a thermobaric hellfire in the building, and that building just goes away.
I bet that stopped the machine gun fire.
Instantly. And so that was amazing. And then, so we go through all this, and then I find out that the Army guys left the radio in the LZ. And then I get ordered to take my Marines and go get it. And I refused the order. I said, I'm not doing it. And they say, you have to get the radio. They didn't zeroize it, so it's still a live radio, and the bad guys will get it, and they'll be able to get our frequencies. And I'm like, I'm not going to do it. So then I get another order, and I said, well, if I get a bunch of soldiers, I'll do it. So I get some soldiers, and we land back in the LZ because we thought we've killed everybody. And then one of my pilots, they put the Army guys out to get the gear. There's helmets, flak jackets, and a radio. They can't pick it up because they're literally that emaciated of their strength. So then all the Marines get out of the Huey, leaving the pilot all by himself. And at that exact moment, about, we don't know the total number, but somewhere between 12 and 30 Iraqis try to overrun the LZ. So I get a pilot of mine screaming on the radio, burner, shoot, shoot. And I'm like, you know, in the book, I call him Hawk. And I said, Hawk, I don't know where the fire's coming from. So we have three Cobras. All my Marines, I could see them. They're all fighting. I can't see any bad guys. And mm-hmm. Hawk says, it's coming from the buildings off my nose. There's five buildings, and we unleash holy hell on these buildings. We put missiles in every one, rockets, 20-millimeter machine gun fire, and we just devastate them. And then we just roll in, and we can't shoot where the guys are because my Marines are fighting, and mm-hmm. so are these soldiers. And then what we do is we just start laying down a sheath of weaponry, just tearing these guys up. Hawk still can't get out, he can't get off the ground because no one's in his helicopter. He's in a helicopter all by himself. So we go and we shoot and we shoot, and we're my section with me and one other Cobra, and I was using a Hawk's wingman, another Cobra. My section is completely out of ammo. And so what we're doing is we're doing fake gun runs and popping flares off our helicopter. Just they don't know what those are.
To keep
their
head down, yeah.
To keep their heads down. And finally, Hawk gets all his guys back. We get them out. And then we take the radio back. I left the gear. We left most of the gear in the LZ. I said, screw that. Just get the radio.
Mm-hmm.
Take the soldiers back. And then Hawk says, hey, sir, I want to get some payback. And so I asked the battalion commander if we could just devastate everything. And he says, yeah. So we come in. I actually had one toe left at this time.
Mm-hmm.
I put a toe in the truck. Hawk comes in, and we just smoke check everybody. That was amazing. Now, we all thought every one of our helicopters was full of bullet holes because there were guys shooting machine guns at me from 200 feet. I'm 200 feet in the air, and I have a guy shooting a Rambo-style machine gun at me. Right, you know, I can see his face, but I had no ammo. My wingman killed him. Not one bullet hole in one gunfighter aircraft. Not one.
Gee, that's like an A-Team episode.
It was.
Nobody gets hit.
not one hole. The Huey, Hawk comes back, and he says, hey, sir, I'm limping back. I think I'm all shot to hell.
And no bullet holes.
Not one. So I put this in the book. I go, God loves the gunfighters.
Yeah, I saw
and,
that.
He did.
I saw
he
that.
Did, and we got out of there. So that was amazing. And then, you know, one of the most there's two things that took place that probably have the biggest impact on me as a squadron commander. And one of them was, is I'm sitting at my desk one day, and I think I've already flown or I'm not flying. I can't remember. And my duty calls me up, and he says, hey, sir, I think you should go down the flight line. And I said, what's up? He goes, they're pouring blood out of a Huey. I said, okay. So I walk down there, and there's blood everywhere, and one of my Marines is coming out of flight equipment with a brand-new flight suit. And I go look at the pilots, and both their inboard arms are covered in blood. And what happened is they rescued some soldiers that had been shot, that had blown up. One of them died, one of them didn't. And I'm looking at this crew, and they go, sir, we're fine. We got to go. We got another mission. And they just turn and burn and go out and do it again. And at the end of the day, I call them all in my office, and I'm like, how you guys doing? They're like, stoic, but they're like, we're fine, sir. We saved one guy today. You know, they were eaten up that they didn't save both.
Right.
So things like that, as a commanding officer, it impacts everybody. But as a commanding officer, you know, you carry that with you because you are seeing what your men and women are doing on a daily basis.
Yeah, you're going through it vicariously.
You're going through it vicariously because you're praying to God that they all make it out alive, you know?
Right.
But you can't allow anyone, as a commander, you cannot allow anyone to, and, you know, none of them were, thank goodness, but you can't allow anyone to be timid. They've got to put their ass on the line every day or they're not doing their job.
Right.
And, you know, you can't say to them, you know, I don't know that I ever said, hey, be careful out there.
No.
You know what I mean? I don't know that I did. I'm out, hey, mission first, go kill everybody. So if I did, you know, one of my Marines may remind me one day, but I don't recall ever saying be careful because nothing we do is careful.
No, by definition, it is danger. All right, stand by. We're at the 3/4 of the hour mark, and it's flying by, and I haven't gotten to a lot of what I wanted to. So stand by, and we'll be right back after this.
Swap shop trains are coming, rolling down that free market track.
Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the swap shop. Let's listen.
This is Caroline.
Happy chickens.
We have a 5-acre horse property for sale.
They're participating in the program.
Please make that part of the package.
A ranch with chickens. They might call that the chicken ranch.
I've been called worse.
Swap shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m. right before Liberty Watch. Imagine that this is your daughter.
What do you want?
Now you get to decide how this scene ends. Or...
Stop, Earl! Stop!
Some misinformed people want to take away your daughter's choice between rape and self-defense. We're pro-choice on self-defense. Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership, jpfo.org.
Welcome back to the last segment with Colonel William Dunn of the book Gunfighter's Rule. It's a 30-plus year career in the Marine Corps, from starting out as a 17-year-old enlisted man and retiring as a colonel in charge of a Marine Expeditionary Unit. It's phenomenally well done. And talk a little bit about the role of the families and how we can support the people that support the Marines and other members of the service.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Thank you for that question. We have a phrase in the Marine Corps that we say, don't whistle while you pack. And when I first found out I was going to Iraq as a forward air controller, I wanted to go. Not that I wanted to be, I'm not a warmonger, but I wanted to support my Marine Corps, support my country, and I wanted to go. I was at a school at the time. Called Command and Staff. You know, never in my time had they ever pulled anyone out of school to go into combat. So my wife and my children think that I'm safe, that I'm not going into combat. Well, I pushed and pushed, and initially I got myself in there, but then we ended up taking all the forward air controllers out of the school and sending them to Iraq. And then when I was packing up, ready to go, my wife still didn't believe me initially. And I'm like, I'm trying to convince her, I'm going, I'm leaving in a week. And she's like, you're not going. And I said, look, they just issued me these tan camis. And when she saw the tan camis, she realized that. And so it was just a different thing, because my wife, you know, she married me because she thinks I'm a tough guy, right? Marine. So she wasn't that worried about it. She knew I could handle just about anything. My older daughter, Big S, I think she felt I was okay, but my younger daughter, the Bug, when she found out I was leaving, she goes to school, and one of her friends says, well, your dad's going to die. And that had a grave impact on her. I will tell you, I'm not sure she's still over it. And so she thought I wasn't coming back. And that scenario is played out with families across our services all the time. And by the way, peacetime or combat, many times people leave, and on nearly every deployment, I would say somebody doesn't come home on a large-scale deployment.
Even in training. So it's
even in training.
Yeah.
And I have lost more friends in training than I have in combat,
mm-hmm.
physically people that I know.
Right.
And so that is a toll on every family. And, you know, I'm a smart guy, right? I wasn't even thinking about it when I deployed. I was not for one second in my mind thinking of the impact this combat deployment was going to have on them. And I'm not because I'm selfish, right? But because I was so focused about going. And then after a while, after the first 60, 80 days of combat, at some point we were able to get to a base where we had relatively normal communications back home.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm talking to Mimi, and she tells me, she says, hey, Laura's having a problem. Laura's the Bug. And I go, what do you mean? And she's like, well, she built a shrine to you in the bathroom, in the tub. And so that is what families go through. And, you know, fortunately, I have been blessed because on every one of my deployment, I've been able to bring every one of my Marines and sailors home alive. And so I consider myself beyond blessed by the Lord because of that, and blessed by my Marines and sailors who not only kept me alive, but, you know, their aggressiveness kept themselves alive.
Mm-hmm.
We all came back, but many of my peers have deployed and not brought everybody back, and that's very hard on them. I don't know one commander. Well, I'm thinking of a very good friend of mine who fought in Fallujah, and he left 23 of his Marines. He didn't leave them there, but he lost 23 of his Marines. And, you know, to this day, he lives with that. And it's tough.
Yeah, McVeigh in the Indianapolis. Was it McVeigh in the Indianapolis? Or was he in the Pueblo? I can't remember the commander of it. But both of them, those guys blamed themselves.
Yeah, well, you know, you cannot... You cannot shed responsibility.
No.
You could do it. You know, you're going into combat. Marines are going to die. It's not anybody's fault necessarily. I mean, sure, there could be someone's fault, right?
Right.
You know, maybe you make a bad tactical decision and, you know, you someone gets killed because of that. But that's not normally what happens. What normally happens is force on force. Everybody's fighting to stay alive. We kill them. They kill us. And it happens.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying anywhere that I know that I would blame one of the commanders that I know for the death of their Marines, because it's not their fault.
In what way does that sharpen your leadership philosophy?
I would say you analyze risk more.
Mm.
Everything's risky, right? Everything's risky. So what do? You have to accept risk where you can. And where you don't want to accept risk because maybe it's not a tactical reason, you don't. I think commanders become very sharp in combat because of that.
Hmm. Now let's talk about transitioning from a military career to a civilian career. Talk about the realities of that.
Well, for me, it was very easy.
Hmm.
I had spent 33 years in the Marine Corps. I had commanded two units for 2 years each, both deploying over, you know, over 9 months on each deployment. And I had intended to retire after the MU command. And then another command opportunity came up for another year deployment. I mean, I hadn't been back. I had just changed command to the MU. So I'd been back for a little while. I had to do a little mini deployment, which I was glad to do. I was very excited to do, you know, supporting the MU goes down and does a show and tell, if you will, to support the Navy and the Marine Corps. And we went down to Tampa and then to Louisiana. And that was great. And then this command came up, and I wanted to go again. And this was the first time Mimi had said to me, she says, it's someone else's turn. And I would have deployed after being gone for 9 months. I would have deployed a week later for another year, not even thinking of batting an eye. So it was perfect time for me to retire. So I retired and I opened my own company called Strategic Resilience Group with two retired Marines that I've known forever. And we were going to be a training company.
Mm-hmm.
And so I told Mimi, I said, you know, I feel blessed. I said, for 33 years, I thought about killing people every day and fighting every day.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm a man of peace. I own my own company, and I'm going to be doing training. Well, our first client was a consulting client known as Israeli Military Industries.
Oh, IMI.
IMI. And guess what they do?
Oh, yeah. They ever. Lots of it. Yeah, they did they make you a nice custom baby eagle or desert eagle?
Not yet, but they're still our customer, and for 9 years we've been supporting them. And first customer, first client, I'm bringing weapons back in the Marine Corps. I come home and I said, I'm back in.
Yep.
So for me, the transition was easy, and I'm going down this week to go see. He won't be there. His mom just passed. But one of my Marines is now the commander of 22 MU.
Oh, good.
And so we train the MUs. We start them out in their first 2 weeks of training. Mm-hmm. Our company does that. So we're going down to talk to him and to some other former MUE commanders on Wednesday, and it's very exciting. So for me, the transition was easy because I'm still doing all
You're still doing all that stuff.
I was doing.
Yeah, except the live fire stuff. Mark, Mark, very fast, single question for William Dunn.
Yes, many people think the war in Iraq is over, but it is not. And my son is a Marine Sergeant Scout Sniper Razorback and is in a team kind of like what you direct. And I asked him if he knew you, but he didn't know who you yet. But anyway, so every day where he's posted for a couple of months, he was rocketed by the local insurgents in Iraq.
We're down to the last 30 seconds, Mark.
So how hot is that war over there right now?
Thank you.
Okay, great. It's still on. I've got four employees in Iraq right now. Every time they get attacked, I get a report whether they're alive or dead. The war is real. When the absurdity of our vice president said we don't have anybody in harm's way, absurdity. That pissed everybody off, by the way. We have men and women in harm's way all over the world, all over the planet right now. And, you know, thank your son, Devil Dog, for his service. And I am sure he's in the thick of it over there. And the reality is the war goes on.
And William, that's all the time we have. Let's not make this an isolated incident. We should have you back again. I really want to. I want to finish the book, and let's reschedule this for 30 days, and I'll have finished the book, okay?
Yes, sir. I'm all on board. I look forward to it.
I love it. Yes, sir. A colonel just said yes, sir, to a civilian. Thank you. I don't deserve that, sir. Colonel Dunn,
ultimately,
I got to let
you. We work for you.
I know.